Hello, everyone out there, and welcome to the mythogenetic moment. I'm using that term to introduce this brief audio commentary that I am providing with the recent post on metahistory.org. Today is June 11th, 2011, and a few days ago I posted the piece in which this audio clip is linked, The True Anarchy of Life on Earth. It should be noted that this is the first piece of material, of new material, new writing, on MetaHistory.org since the correction, which took place on March 19th of 2011. So we are now technically in a post-correction experience of life on Earth. And I am going to use audio commentaries like this occasionally along with the written material to make it eminently clear what I mean by a post-correction experience. In order to introduce this notion, I am pleased to cite a reference to Joseph Campbell. On a website entitled Infinite Future, there is a definition of the term mythogenetic moment. And it goes like this. Joseph Campbell had a term for the nodal moment or temporal vortex. He called it the mythogenetic moment. On the first page of Creative Mythology, he signaled the 12th century as the last great mythogenetic moment in the history of Western civilization. Campbell felt passionately that the transition into the 21st century could be a mythogenetic moment morally and spiritually equivalent to the 12th century, and possibly even resonant with it. End quote. I couldn't agree more, and the resonance between the 21st century and the 12th century, a mere juxtaposition of numbers, is an immense point of orientation for our species. And in all of the post-correction material that's going to appear on MetaHistory.org, all of it, in the future, will be consecrated to this aim, to explain, in both visionary and practical terms, what is the post-correction experience on the planet Earth. So, to begin, I'd like to preface my presentation with a definition. Campbell has given us the term mythogenetic moment, and taking his work as a springboard, I would like to propose the term mythogenetic method for the way that I will now proceed to transmit the Sophia myth and the practical and visionary aspects of planetary tantra. I'm going to use the mythogenetic method. Campbell didn't use that term, but it proceeds in perfect and simple logic from his research and from the groundwork that he laid. It is, in fact, a natural extrapolation of Campbell. By the mythogenetic method, I mean an actual way which I will demonstrate and which you can learn by example from me, if you wish, a way to frame the events of the world today and a way to frame your own experiences. This method is a technique of framing events within a plot or storyline. You can take any events in your personal life, in society, in the social group around you, the culture in which you live, and you can take the events unfolding on the global scale today, and you can frame them in a mythical plot, in a narrative. And this is the mythogenetic method. This is the method that allows us as a species, a storytelling species, to orient ourselves in the most effective and direct and lucid, sober, and even enlightened manner to the course of our own experiences. Because we are storytelling animals, we function best when we have a mythical or narrative framework for our experiences. I ask you to bear with me in this new approach. I am standing here talking into a void. If I do not sound as fluent as I might, and if my delivery is awkward at moments, you will understand why this is so. I certainly would prefer to speak to a living person, but this is the way it's being done at the moment. Now, if I can make you comfortable with the notion of a mythogenetic method, I would be quite happy. So before we proceed, let me say a little bit more about this method. It's really just a way of tracking a course of events. Consider, for instance, that there's some breaking news, such as riots in some major American city, food riots. And this is a breaking story on the news. And so the reporters, back in the days when there used to be really such things as reporters, would go out from the news center and gather information at the site of the event. They would interview the rioters. They would take footage of the setting. And then they would put these bits of information together and follow the story of events, follow the storyline, breaking story. And in order for the information gathered by one or more reporters to be meaningful, it would have to be plotted along what is called in film writing, screenwriting, a story arc. So there's a story arc, a beginning, a middle, and an end. And along the curve of the story arc, different events occur. And the interpretation of those events depends on how they are shaped by the story arc itself. So the story arc is not merely a passive repository where one collects events. The story arc, or the plot of the story, actually gives direction and structure. Excuse me for that interruption. So what we're doing with the mythogenetic method is laying down current events against a story arc, along a story arc, so that we can track those events in a meaningful way, and so that we can react in an intentional and deliberate and effective way toward those events in respect to how they play along the story arc. If you understand the overall plot of events, then you can act effectively within the framework of those events. If you don't get the plot, then your action is going to be at best lucky and haphazard. Another concept that might make you put you at ease with this notion is the concept of NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. I said originally, when metahistory.org went online in July 2002, that belief drives behavior. This is one of the principal teachings of metahistory.org. Belief drives behavior. Well, we know now with the work of Bruce Lipton and other people on the biology of belief that this is not merely an abstract proposition, but is biologically correct. Belief affects and shapes the NLP, or the neuro-linguistic programming circuits in the brain, and those circuits in turn determine how people act and react. So I would say, along the lines of that analogy, that the mythogenetic method is a way of establishing a narrative root in your NLP. It sets up a narrative root. It sets up a rooting through your NLP, because a narrative will actually root your NLP. A story will root your NLP and your neuronal processes in a certain direction. For instance, if you accept a story of the creation of the earth as it's told in Genesis of the Bible, that narrative, that myth or story will root your NLP in a certain direction. And consequently, all of your interpretations, your insights, your actions and reactions, both at a personal, social, and transpersonal level, at all those levels, will reflect the rooting of your NLP according to the story arc. Now, this is an extremely important principle and a fundamental principle. If you know this principle, you will be able to see your way into many, many, many experiences. But there's a trick here. And the trick is something that needs to be disclosed at the absolute outset before I proceed with a specific comment on this post-correction material. I can assure you that any narrative in a mythological form or in a news story form, a narrative such as the official explanation of the 9/11 attacks, or a narrative such as the myth of Eros and Psyche, take your pick. May it be a news story, a government explanation of something, or an ancient myth. These are all on equal par as narratives, and they will all root your NLP. So any narrative can root your NLP, but not any narrative can root your NLP to source. And this is the fundamental principle that I want to introduce, both as a learning tool and as a path of self-application for all the post-correction material that I'm now going to be presenting. Not any narrative will root your NLP to source. In fact, I can assure you in the strongest possible terms and without any reservation whatsoever that there is only one narrative on this planet that can root your NLP to source. So you can do as you wish. I am not here to force anything on anyone. If you want to take the Flash Gordon plot, if you want to go back to the Flash Gordon episodes, which you can probably find on YouTube, and pick up the story of the battle between the evil Ming and Flash Gordon, or if you want to go to Superman comics and pick up the plot of Superman saving the earth from one villain or another, or if you want to go to the Batman films and take that narrative, you can take any narrative you want. You can take narratives transmitted from the Pleiades by various channelers. You can take the narratives of Madame Blavatsky. You can take the narratives of any number of channelers and New Age visionaries. You can take the narrative of David Icke. You can take the narrative of Zachariah Sitchin. And none of these narratives will root your NLP to source. Why not? Because they are not narratives about source. The only source that concerns us here is the one that is totally, imminently, and immensely present and voracious, and that is the planet itself. If you're going to argue with me that the planet is source, you may as well stop listening right now. As far as I'm concerned, it's more than obvious that I'm standing here talking and you're listening to me because the planet is source. It's not only the source of your body, the fluids in your body, the air in your lungs. It's not only the source of all your sensations that pour into your body. It's not only the source of the desire that lives in your body, in the iron streaming of your blood as a real electromagnetic and bioelectromagnetic flux. It's not only the source of your emotions and your memories. It's the source of your psyche. It's the source of your mind. It's the source of everything. The planet is the source, the immediate and imminent source. Now, there are other sources. One may well ask, well, John, you say the planet is the source, but what's the source of the planet? Well, source of the planet is the galaxy. Source of the galaxy is the central hub of the galaxy. Then you may ask, okay, so what's the source of the central hub of the galaxy? Well, the source of the central hub of the galaxy is the originator or unity field, which is outside of space and time. That is the source of all the galaxies. So let's say we're looking at triple sourcing. Planetary source, source in our local galaxy, source of all the galaxies, the universe of galaxies. That is the triple source paradigm. And what concerns us first is the source that is most immediate to us, because we get to the other sources through the immediate and eminent source, which is the planet. So what I'm saying is, you're free to go and latch on to any narrative and story you want from any channeler or any source of spiritual or metaphysical or scientific information that you choose. But I'm here to tell you that the only story or narrative that will root your NLP to source is a story about the source. And as I've said before, there is only one story or one myth about the source, that is the planet Earth, the immediate and imminent source. There is only one completely coherent myth with a complete and open-ended story arc, and that is the Sophia myth from the Pagan Mysteries. So that is the master narrative, that is the sacred narrative for tracking events that happen to us in the personal world, in our personal world, in our microcosmos of the self, in the intermediary world of society, and in the greater world of the cosmos at large, out to the very reaches of our galaxy. The mythogenetic method is a way of tracking events along the story arc of Sophia. Now, this may seem like a very remote way to go about business, but as a matter of fact, I wish to demonstrate, and I certainly will demonstrate in the immediate future, how this method, although it comes from an apparent complexity, actually resolves and distills into utter simplicity and into the application of the story in direct and immediate experience. I assure you, don't have to take my word for it, just stay on board to learn about it. And you can decide for yourself whether this method is veracious and applicable or not. I say that it is because I live by it. And for me, it has become a constant reality and a constant guiding frame for my experience. And that is what Joseph Campbell was pointing to when he talked about the high potential of creative mythology and the breakthrough into a new mythogenetic moment at the dawn of the 21st century, right now. So with that 20-minute preface out of the way, I'd like to go directly to this posting, The True Anarchy of Life on Earth, and walk you through it in order to illustrate how I am presenting this technique of tracking events and experiences on a story arc or narrative or within a mythological framework. The True Anarchy of the Earth opens with a citation from a Gnostic text on the origin of the world. Now bear in mind that this paragraph describes an event that is said to have happened, according to Gnostic seers in the Mysteries, inconceivably long ago, many, many aeons or ages ago. In fact, this is an event that happened in the limbs of our galaxy. That was the location or setting of the event. It happened in the limbs of our galaxy, in the third limb, where the solar system is now still located. As the form of the solar system was taking shape through the concentrations of particulate and inorganic matter, if you want to use that conception, through the flux and densification of plasmatic fields, if you want to use that syntax, which I think is probably becoming more relevant even as I speak. So the event of the arising or emergence of the solar system was the occasion for a confrontation between the goddess Sophia, who had not yet been transformed into the earth, so we're talking about a pre-terrestrial moment here, between the goddess Sophia, the Aeon Sophia, and the Archon entities who appear in the galactic limbs as a result of the impact of her plasmatic organic light upon the particulate matter of the galactic limbs. And this is actually the event that's being described. This is not a fantasy. This is a report. This is a mythopoetic description encoding events that happened in reality and in the physical astronomical formation of the solar system. In this essay, I point out that the emergence of the Archons, the extraterrestrial aliens, was an event that Sophia had not anticipated. Now, the goddess Sophia originated in the galactic core. She is one of the divine creator beings, or aeons, from the Pleroma, the galactic core. And she is, as such, not human and ought not to be conceived or imagined in an anthropomorphic form. Be best to imagine her as a huge serpent-like torrent of living and animated plasmic luminosity. Yet this torrent has a voice, has a mind, has emotions, can speak, can perceive. It is a living entity. It is a super organism on the galactic scale. And when this superorganism found itself circulating in the region of the galactic limbs where aeons do not normally venture, it was confronted with an unanticipated event, which was the emergence of this Archon species. Prior to her departure from the galactic core, Sophia had pictured in her own mind, she had envisioned or fantasized, if you will, about a three-body cosmos consisting of a moon, a sun, and a planet. And she conceived that as the ideal setting where one particular strain of the human species could evolve and emerge and experiment and learn and play. And she became deeply obsessed with this possibility, this divine experiment, this divine adventure. And as you know, because I've told this story many times now, due to her intense fascination for this experiment that was yet to unfold, she was drawn away from the galactic center and she became enmeshed in the experiment. And the first and a number of unanticipated events resulted from that. First of those being the appearance of the Archons. I explain here that the Coco de Mer is the icon for the world dreaming of Sophia as it came to be realized in her metamorphosis into the earth. But this was the original three-body system as she conceived it before the solar system was produced. And so she did not conceive that the sun, moon, and earth would become captured in this celestial mechanics of the solar system. She did not anticipate that. So the planetary spheres in the realm of the solar system is what we call the matrix. The Telestai describe the Archons as warders and gatekeepers in the labyrinth of the planetary prison. As you know, this term prison planet has become very much in vogue these days, and it is the calling card for InfoWars and other people who declare themselves to be enemies of the globalist mafia, the dominators, and the globalist elite. So the Matrix is the holographic maze of archonic deception in which the human race appears to be the progeny of off-planet gods, or appears to be enslaved by interspecies predators who claim descent from such gods, and so forth. Although we come to learn, as we track history along the story arc of the Sophia myth, that those ways of viewing the human species are in fact delusional. They are hoaxes. It is a hoax that we are the progeny of off-planet gods, because the myth says very clearly that we are the progeny of the pleromic divinities at the core of the galaxy. We are not the progeny of any other non-human or ET species that happens to be floating around in the limbs of the galaxy. We're from the source. We are not from the limbs, the kanoma, or realm of finite potential. So I describe that situation, and I also describe my amazing discovery that the notion that the spontaneous generation of locust-like archon species is not as wild as it may appear at first, because in fact an experiment performed in 1837 shows this to be possible on a microcosmic scale. The Akari insects produced by Andrew Cross, and that is the most fantastic corroboration, if you will, via science of an extraordinary and outrageous feature of the Sophianic myth. So I cover all that there, and then I go into a series of events chronologically regarding experiences that Sophia lived through. So we go through these eight events, and included in these events is the confrontation between Sophia and the Archons, in which she defies them, and she reads them the riot act, as it were, stating very clearly that there is an immortal luminous child, the Anthropos, who came into existence before you. That's because humanity was engineered and pre-visioned in the galactic core before the Archons appeared. And who will appear among your modeled forms, this luminous child will trample you in scorn, just as the potter's clay is pounded into a lump. For at the consummation of your work, the entire defect of archonic illusion, exposed in the light of truth, will be abolished. And that illusion will be as if it had never been. So, the Gnostic seers tell us that there was an event that occurred in the cosmos even before humanity appeared on Earth and even before the Earth itself existed, which predicted, in a way, a confrontation between humanity and the archonic deceivers. So we go to this remote event, which may seem like a long, long way around to get back to where we are today. But as a matter of fact, it's not really so far. Because when we look at what is happening today, we can say that there is a kind of compression of time. We can say that in the imagination and in the scope of these cosmological events, there is no time as such in a strict linear sense, but there are fractal layers of time compacted into other fractal layers and into other fractal layers, so that you can telescope down from the moment in the remote past, from that vast panorama moment, you can telescope right down fractally through time to the current moment. You can say that then was now, and now is then. And the moment of this confrontation is now. The only difference is that the original confrontation, as described in the Gnostic cosmological texts, happened before Sophia turned into the Earth and the Earth became captured in the solar system. The moment now, we are standing on the Earth, we are standing on her body, we are sitting, we are deposited, embedded in her skin, and we are looking at that cosmological proposition from the realized viewpoint of the imminent reality of terrestrial existence. And this is the moment when the events predetermined, as it were, at that time, prefigured at that time, would be a better word, when the events prefigured at that moment come to be enacted and resolved. So going further down, I explain the so-called archon plexus, or the R complex of the brain, and how it is actually seized upon by the archontic powers, who have a way of entrancing us and entraining us through the force of gravity, which is artificially lent to the Earth realm. Force of gravity that inheres in the planetary system beyond the Earth does not belong to the biodynamics of the Earth itself. And so this borrowed effect from the planetary system gives the archons a certain advantage on us, speaking in purely physical terms, speaking in terms of the physics of space, time, and gravity, if that's any, of any interest to you. It could be helpful, perhaps, to know that the role that the R complex plays in humanity's struggle with the authorities, as the archons are sometimes called, the rulers and authorities. We are, in a certain respect, at risk of falling under their spell. But I want to emphasize, and I must emphasize over and over again, as we track our history along the story arc of the Sophia myth, I must emphasize that part of falling under the spell is the illusion of being under the spell. To a certain extent, we really are under the spell, but to a much greater extent, we are in the illusion of being under the spell. And that is the trick of the authorities. That is their supreme trick, that their spell works through a hoaxing or simulation. It is as if we are under their spell. On the other hand, we cannot entirely deny that we are under their spell, but we are not under their spell to the extent that their spell would have us believe. And that is the trick of the archons. To fall under the spell of the authorities is to concede power to their false magic. Under the power of deception, we deceive ourselves about what power really is and lose all sense of our own power. What is our power? Our power consists in acting cooperatively with Source. That is our power. Our power inheres in the unique opportunity of our role in the divine experiment of Sophia, which is interactive magic with the Wisdom Goddess. Claiming this power is the only sure and direct way and the ultimate way to detect and defeat the illusional power of the authorities. So if we track ourselves on this story arc of the Sophia mythos, if we place ourselves in the present mythogenetic moment of our species, a very rare moment of opportunity, then what do we see? We see that the confrontation with the archonic powers has reached the moment described in the sacred text. The archons, the authorities, the powers of hoaxing and illusion, those who perpetrate a false war on terror in order to terrorize the world, those deluded and demented powers are at the consummation of their work. They have been at the consummation of their work since September 9/11. And coming about 10 years after that date, on March 19th, 2011, Gaia, as Sophia, reestablished a two-way signal connection and a two-way communication, real-time communication, with the aeons of the Pleromic Center, the center of our galaxy. So the planet Earth, as a living superorganism, is now in real-time, two-way communication with the galactic center. That is Sophia's correction. That is one way to describe her correction. The correction begins with her ascending from the Earth through a sonic boom that comes from the barycenter of the Earth, a set of signal coordinates to the galactic center, to the Pleroma. This set of signaling coordinates establishes them to scan back and locate exactly where she is in the galactic limbs and reconnect with her through signals coming from the galactic center. So this two-way signaling process has now begun, and this is one way to pictorialize in a story form the correction of the Aeon Sophia, which was foreseen in the Gnostic mythology. We are now in correction with her, and everything depends upon being able to track the process of correction as she experiences it. Can we do that? We certainly can. I'm doing it right now. I've been doing it for almost 3 months, and I can assure you again, don't take my word for it, but if you want to stick around and learn, I can show you how I do it, and by example, you can learn to do it. It involves following the story. It involves tracking her myth in the present and the future. The unique power of the Sophia myth is that it is not only a myth that connects us to Source, but it is an open-ended myth. Our connection as individuals and as a species to Source does not have a pre-written or pre-scripted conclusion. The conclusion depends upon a power-sharing, a cooperative arrangement between human beings and the living consciousness of the Earth. It's as simple as that. That is what determines where the myth goes from here on. So, as long as we establish ourselves on the narrative, in the narrative framework, and continually reestablish ourselves in that story over and over again, we will be able to take the direction with her that she is taking, and that is the future part of the story. That starts right now. So, to briefly conclude this commentary, I'm just going to scan quickly over the two remaining sections of this essay, Disclosure Made Official, being the first. I'm going to point out here that at the consummation of their works, the Archons, in their form as an extraterrestrial locust cyborg-type species, would probably be obligated to reveal themselves in some way. But that revealing of the ET presence, which is popularly known as disclosure, cannot be anything but a hoax. It can only be a hoax because their very existence is a hoax. And so disclosure is likely to come in the end game of the globalist of the Globalist Mind Program / terror hoax scenario. And I just want to point out that the main thing you need to know about the Archons, you can know by asking yourself this question. Well, the Archons are said to be agents of deceptions. So how do you know when they're lying and when they're not lying? The answer is, they always lie. They do nothing but lie. And so anything that concerns the Archons is a lie. Anything that concerns them, that comes from them, is a lie. But anything that concerns them, that can be shown to have meaning in the framework of Sophia's story, that's not a lie. That is the true perspective that we need to have on these intrusive and predatory entities. They do really exist. I don't say that their existence is a lie. They do really exist as mind parasites. And I strongly sense that they do exist, that they have some kind of physical existence as ETs in the solar system at large, although they cannot inhabit the planet Earth, nor do they inhabit the moon, nor do they inhabit the sun, except for a dissident group of Archons called Paralemptors, who do inhabit the sun, which is cold inside, by the way. So, this is something to be borne in mind, something of paramount importance. I'm not saying the Archons don't exist and they're an illusion. The Archons are not an illusion, but their expressions toward humanity are all faked. And any authority on this earth, any government, any person who comes forth and makes the disclosure of the Archons is a dupe and a fake. And it's not going to change anything. It's just going to add more. Such a disclosure will just add more confusion and doubt and fear to the world psyche, and can be more or less disregarded as insignificant. Finally, we come to the notion of moral illusion, which is the subtitle heading of the last section of the essay. And I explain what moral illusions are. And so this relates to the myth as well, because the supreme moral illusion that is confronting humanity concerns not the Archons as an extraterrestrial presence, but the archontic lie as an intrapsychic presence, as an infection of human behavior. The archontic lie is a real infection of human behavior, and it exaggerates human pathology to a point beyond correction. Now, if the Archons were not there, some human beings, some members of our species, might become demented. They might become ill, because that potential is present in our species because of the way that we're endowed with certain mental and emotional faculties in excess of what nature requires. Therefore, we can become alienated from nature, alienated from our source and setting, which is the body of the divine goddess, and we can consequently become very demented. But that dementia that might befall a certain number of the human species in the undisturbed course of Gaia's experiment goes to bizarre and exaggerated lengths due to the infection by the archontic lie. And the deepest cut of this infection is in the perception of one human being to another, the perception between one human being and another, that one human being would perceive that another human being has authority over them. That is the deepest cut of this archontic perception, because no one human being has any authority over any other human being. We are all absolutely sovereign and free individuals in the divine experiment of Gaia Sophia and in her loving imaginative vision. That is how we stand. That is how we live. And so, the supreme moral illusion, as I write, operates like this. Those who falsely assume authority over others demand obedience to their commands on the claim that disobedience would result in some social chaos or anarchy. Whereas in effect, it is that creative chaos and anarchy of the total individuality of every member of the human species that is the fulfillment of Sophia's experiment. That is the condition for fulfilling her divine experiment with us. And so, the archontic lie is now reaching its most extreme form. The moral illusion, or moral illusions, propagated from that archontic lie are reaching monumentally bizarre and absurd proportions. How are we to understand this absurdity? It's very difficult to understand, say, the absurdity of what goes on in a TSA pat-down of a 4-year-old child suspected of terrorism. This is the archons at the consummation of their work. You don't see any archons around. What you just see are these human beings whose behavior has become distorted and demented beyond the scale of correction. How can we stand up and face this? How can we deal with this absolute absurdity, which becomes the vehicle for murderous violence and a rampage across the planet? It's not just a theater of absurdity where the actors walk off the stage unharmed at the end of the day. It's a theater of absurdity where people are being killed en masse and driven insane. And they really are going insane, and they really are dying. The extras in this movie are really killed. Imagine that. Imagine if you went to a film of the French Revolution, a period piece, and you came out and you said, wow, what a fantastic movie, showed what happened in the French Revolution. And somebody standing there in the lobby says to you, oh, by the way, my brother was in that film. He was one of the extras. There were 15,000 extras, and I'd like to tell you that they were all killed. Really killed. They weren't just killed in the film. They were killed in the film and killed. You know, 9/11 was a snuff film on a global scale. And the snuff film, the global snuff film, is still going on, folks. The global snuff film has been playing in Iraq for many, many years. The global snuff film plays in Pakistan when predator drones take out 200 people at a wedding party. And the global snuff film is coming to your neighborhood. There is no place on this planet that is immune to that murderous dementia. This is the consummation of the work of the archons. And how do we face this? Well, I would suggest to you in closing this commentary that we face it in two ways. First, we face it by getting our minds around it, by putting these insane and horrifically absurd events on a story arc, putting them into a narrative frame that connects us to source. Because when we're connected to the source by the story of the source, we have the power of the source behind us to face these events. So we need the mythogenetic method. We need the mythological framework in order to deal with this level of evil. And secondly, we deal with it on a person-to-person basis. You have to deal with it in the existential reality of human interactions. And that goes directly to the category of right action, which is coming up fast on the horizon of metahistory.org. So thank you for listening, and once again, I ask you to bear with me for my flaws of delivery and the awkwardness in which I might be presenting some of this material. I'm certainly not as fluent as I would care to be, but I'm getting it out in this fashion, and I hope that the audio clips that will now accompany some of these writings will be useful to you in the time ahead, and useful in staying in touch with your own power and with the source of that power. Thank you.